Chapter 11. I arrived for orientation at Ohio State in early September 2007, and I couldn't have been more excited. I remember every little detail about that day. Lunch at Chipotle, the first time Lindsay had ever eaten there. The walk from the orientation building to the South Campus house that would soon be my Columbus home. The beautiful weather. I met with a guidance counselor who talked me through my first college schedule, which put me in class only 4 days per week, never before 9:30 in the morning. After the Marine Corps and its 5:30 a.m. wake-ups, I couldn't believe my good fortune. Ohio State's main campus in Columbus is about 100 miles away from Middletown, meaning it was close enough for weekend visits to my family. For the first time in a few years, I could drop in on Middletown whenever I felt like it. And while Havelock, the North Carolina city closest to my Marine Corps base, was not too different from Middletown, Columbus felt like an urban paradise. It was, and remains, one of the fastest-growing cities in the country, powered in large part by the bustling university that was now my home. OSU grads were starting businesses, historic buildings were being converted into new restaurants and bars, and even the worst neighborhoods seemed to be undergoing significant revitalization. Not long after I moved to Columbus, one of my best friends began working as the promotions director for a local radio station, so I always knew what was happening around town and always had an in to the city's best events, from local festivals to VIP seating for the annual fireworks show. In many ways, college was very familiar. I made a lot of new friends, but virtually all of them were from Southwest Ohio. My six roommates included five graduates of Middletown High School and one graduate of Edgewood High School in nearby Trenton. They were a little younger, the Marine Corps had aged me past the age of the typical freshman, but I knew most of them from back home. My closest friends had already graduated or were about to, but many stayed in Columbus after graduation. Though I didn't know it, I was witnessing a phenomenon that social scientists call brain drain. People who are able to leave struggling cities often do, and when they find a new home with educational and work opportunities, they stay there. Years later, I looked at my wedding party of six groomsmen and realized that every single one of them had, like me, grown up in a small Ohio town before leaving for Ohio State. To a man, all of them had found careers outside of their hometowns, and none of them had any interest in ever going back. By the time I started at Ohio State, the Marine Corps had instilled in me an incredible sense of invincibility. I'd go to classes, do my homework, study at the library, and make it home in time to drink well past midnight with my buddies, then wake up early to go running. My schedule was intense, but everything that had made me fear the independent college life when I was 18 felt like a piece of cake now. I had puzzled through those financial aid forms with Mamaw a few years earlier, arguing about whether to list her or Mom as my parent guardian. We had worried that unless I somehow obtained and submitted the financial information of Bob Hamill, my legal father, I'd be guilty of fraud. The whole experience had made both of us painfully aware of how unfamiliar we were with the outside world. I had nearly failed out of high school, earning D's and F's in English 1. Now, I paid my own bills and earned A's in every class I took at my state's flagship university. I felt completely in control of my destiny in a way that I never had before. I knew that Ohio State was put up or shut up time. I had left the Marine Corps not just with a sense that I could do what I wanted, but also with the capacity to plan. I wanted to go to law school, and I knew that to go to the best law school, I'd need good grades and to ace the infamous law school admissions test, or LSAT. There was much I didn't know, of course. I couldn't really explain why I wanted to go to law school, besides the fact that in Middletown, the rich kids were born to either doctors or lawyers, and I didn't want to work with blood. I didn't know how much else was out there, but the little knowledge I had at least gave me direction, and that was all I needed. I loathed debt and the sense of limitation it imposed. Though the GI Bill paid for a significant chunk of my education, and Ohio State charged relatively little to an in-state resident, I still needed to cover about $20,000 of expenses on my own. I took a job at the Ohio State House, working for a remarkably kind senator from the Cincinnati area named Bob Schuller. He was a good man, and I liked his politics, so when constituents called and complained, I tried to explain his positions. I watched lobbyists come and go and overheard the senator and his staff debate whether a particular bill was good for his constituents, good for his state, or good for both. Observing the political process from the inside made me appreciate it in a way that watching cable news never had. Mamaw had thought all politicians were crooks, but I learned that no matter their politics, that was largely untrue at the Ohio State House. After a few months at the Ohio Senate, as my bills piled up and I found fewer and fewer ways to make up the difference between my spending and my income. One can donate plasma only twice per week, I learned. I decided to get another job. One nonprofit advertised a part-time job that paid $10 an hour, but when I showed up for the interview in khakis, an ugly lime green shirt, and Marine Corps combat boots, my only non-sneakers at the time, and saw the interviewer's reaction, I knew that I was out of luck. I barely noticed the rejection email a week later. A local nonprofit did work for abused and neglected children, and they also paid $10 an hour, so I went to Target, bought a nicer shirt and a pair of black shoes, and came away with a job offer to be a consultant. I cared about their mission, and they were great people. I began work immediately. With two jobs and a full-time class load, my schedule intensified, but I didn't mind. I didn't realize there was anything unusual about my commitments until a professor emailed me about meeting after class to discuss a writing assignment. When I sent him my schedule, he was aghast. He sternly told me that I should focus on my education and not let work distractions stand in my way. I smiled, shook his hand, and said thanks, but I did not heed his advice. I liked staying up late to work on assignments, waking up early after only 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and patting myself on the back for being able to do it. After so many years of fearing my own future, of worrying that I'd end up like many of my neighbors or family, addicted to drugs or alcohol, in prison, or with kids that I couldn't or wouldn't take care of, I felt an incredible momentum. I knew the statistics. I had read the brochures in the social worker's office when I was a kid. I had recognized the look of pity from the hygienist at the low-income dental clinic. I wasn't supposed to make it, but I was doing just fine on my own. Did I take it too far? Absolutely. I didn't sleep enough, I drank too much, and ate Taco Bell at nearly every meal. A week into what I thought was just a really awful cold, a doctor told me that I had mono. I ignored him and kept on living as though NyQuil and DayQuil were magical elixirs. After a week of this, my urine turned a disgusting brown shade and my temperature registered 103. I realized I might need to take care of myself, so I downed some Tylenol, drank a couple of beers, and went to sleep. When Mom found out what was happening, she drove to Columbus and took me to the emergency room. She wasn't perfect. She wasn't even a practicing nurse, but she took it as a point of pride to supervise every interaction we had with the healthcare system. She asked the right questions, got annoyed with doctors when they didn't answer directly, and made sure I had what I needed. I spent 2 full days in the hospital as doctors emptied 5 bags of saline to rehydrate me and discovered that I had contracted a staph infection in addition to the mono, which explained why I grew so sick. The doctors released me to Mom, who wheeled me out of the hospital and took me home to recover. My illness lasted another few weeks, which happily coincided with a break between Ohio State's spring and summer terms. When I was in Middletown, I split time between Aunt Wee's and Mom's. Both of them cared for me and treated me like a son. It was my first real introduction to the competing emotional demands of Middletown in a post-Mamaw world. I didn't want to hurt Mom's feelings, but the past had created rifts that would likely never go away. I never confronted these demands head-on. I never explained to Mom that no matter how nice and caring she was at any given time, and while I had mono, she couldn't have been a better mother, I just felt uncomfortable around her. To sleep in her house meant talking to husband number 5, a kind man but a stranger who would never be anything to me but the future ex, Mr. Mom. It meant looking at her furniture and remembering the time I hid behind it during one of her fights with Bob. It meant trying to understand how Mom could be such a contradiction, a woman who sat patiently with me at the hospital for days, and an addict who would lie to her family to extract money from them a month later. I knew that my increasingly close relationship with Aunt Wee hurt Mom's feelings. She talked about it all the time. "I'm your mother, not her," she'd repeat. To this day, I often wonder whether, if I'd had the courage as an adult that I'd had as a child, Mom might have gotten better. Addicts are at their weakest during emotionally trying times, and I knew that I had the power to save her from at least some bouts of sadness, but I couldn't do it any longer. I didn't know what had changed, but I wasn't that person anymore. Perhaps it was nothing more than self-preservation. Regardless, I couldn't pretend to feel at home with her. After a few weeks of mono, I felt well enough to return to Columbus and my classes. I'd lost a lot of weight, 20 pounds over 4 weeks, but otherwise felt pretty good. With the hospital bills piling up, I got a third job as an SAT tutor at the Princeton Review, which paid an incredible $18 an hour. Three jobs were too much, so I dropped the job I loved the most, my work at the Ohio Senate, because it paid the least. I needed money and the financial freedom it provided, not rewarding work. That, I told myself, would come later. Shortly before I left, the Ohio Senate debated a measure that would significantly curb payday lending practices. My senator opposed the bill, one of the few senators to do so, and though he never explained why, I like to think that maybe he and I had something in common. The senators and policy staff debating the bill had little appreciation for the role of payday lenders in the shadow economy that people like me occupied. To them, payday lenders were predatory sharks, charging high interest rates on loans and exorbitant fees for cash checks. The sooner they were snuffed out, the better. To me, payday lenders could solve important financial problems. My credit was awful, thanks to a host of terrible financial decisions, some of which weren't my fault, many of which were, so credit cards weren't a possibility. If I wanted to take a girl out to dinner, or needed a book for school and didn't have money in the bank, I didn't have many options. I probably could have asked my aunt or uncle, but I desperately wanted to do things on my own. One Friday morning, I dropped off my rent check, knowing that if I waited another day, the $50 late fee would kick in. I didn't have enough money to cover the check, but I'd get paid that day and would be able to deposit the money after work. However, after a long day at the Senate, I forgot to grab my paycheck before I left. By the time I realized the mistake, I was already home, and the statehouse staff had left for the weekend. On that day, a 3-day payday loan, with a few dollars of interest, enabled me to avoid a significant overdraft fee. The legislators debating the merits of payday lending didn't mention situations like that. The lesson? Powerful people sometimes do things to help people like me without really understanding people like me. My second year of college started pretty much as my first year had, with a beautiful day and a lot of excitement. With the new job, I was a bit busier, but I didn't mind the work. What I did mind was the gnawing feeling that, at 24, I was a little too old to be a second-year college student. But with 4 years in the Marine Corps behind me, more separated me from the other students than age. During an undergraduate seminar in foreign policy, I listened as a 19-year-old classmate with a hideous beard spouted off about the Iraq War. He explained that those fighting the war were typically less intelligent than those, like him, who immediately went to college. It showed, he argued, in the wanton way soldiers butchered and disrespected Iraqi civilians. It was an objectively terrible opinion. My friends from the Marine Corps spanned the political spectrum and had held nearly every conceivable opinion about the war. Many of my Marine Corps friends were staunch liberals who had no love for our commander-in-chief, then George W. Bush, and felt that we had sacrificed too much for too little gain. But none of them had ever uttered such unreflective tripe. As the student prattled on, I thought about the never-ending training on how to respect Iraqi culture. Never show anyone the bottom of your foot. Never address a woman in traditional Muslim garb without first speaking to a male relative. I thought about the security we provided for Iraqi poll workers and how we studiously explained the importance of their mission without ever pushing our own political views on them. I thought about listening to a young Iraqi who couldn't speak a word of English flawlessly rap every single word of 50 Cent's "Into Club," and laughing along with him and his friends. I thought about my friends who were covered in third-degree burns, lucky to have survived an IED attack in the Al-Qaim region of Iraq. And here was this dipshit in a spotty beard telling our class that we murdered people for sport. I felt an immediate drive to finish college as quickly as possible. I met with a guidance counselor and plotted my exit. I'd need to take classes during the summer and more than double the full-time course load during some terms. It was, even by my heightened standards, an intense year. During a particularly terrible February, I sat down with my calendar and counted the number of days since I'd slept more than 4 hours in a day. The tally was 39. But I continued, and in August 2009, after 1 year and 11 months at Ohio State, I graduated with a double major, summa cum laude. I tried to skip my graduation ceremony, but my family wouldn't let me. So I sat in an uncomfortable chair for 3 hours before I walked across the podium and received my college diploma. When Gordon Gee, then president of The Ohio State University, paused for an unusually long photograph with the girl who stood in front of me in line, I extended my hand to his assistant, nonverbally asking for the diploma. She handed it to me, and I stepped behind Dr. Gee and down off the podium. I may have been the only graduating student that day to not shake his hand. On to the next one, I thought. I knew I'd go to law school after the next year. My August graduation precluded a 2009 start to law school, so I moved home to save money. Aunt Wee had taken Mamaw's place as the family matriarch. She put out the fires, hosted family gatherings, and kept us all from breaking apart. She had always provided me with a home base after Mamaw's death, but 10 months seemed like an imposition. I didn't like the idea of disrupting her family's routine, but she insisted. JD, this is your home now. It's the only place for you to stay. Those last months, living in Middletown, were among the happiest of my life. I was finally a college graduate, and I knew that I'd soon accomplish another dream, going to law school. I worked odd jobs to save money and grew closer to my aunt's two daughters. Every day I'd get home from work, dusty and sweaty from manual labor, and sit at the dinner table to hear my teenage cousins talk about their days at school and trials with friends. Sometimes I'd help with homework. On Fridays during Lent, I helped with the fish fries at the local Catholic church. That feeling I had in college, that I had survived decades of chaos and heartbreak and finally come out on the other side, deepened. The incredible optimism I felt about my own life contrasted starkly with the pessimism of so many of my neighbors. Years of decline in the blue-collar economy manifested themselves in the material prospects of Middletown's residents. The Great Recession and the not-great recovery that followed had hastened Middletown's downward trajectory. But there was something almost spiritual about the cynicism of the community at large, something that went much deeper than a short-term recession. As a culture, we had no heroes. Certainly not any politician. Barack Obama was then the most admired man in America, and likely still is. But even when the country was enraptured by his rise, most Middletonians viewed him suspiciously. George W. Bush had few fans in 2008. Many loved Bill Clinton, but many more saw him as the symbol of American moral decay, and Ronald Reagan was long dead. We loved the military, but had no George S. Patton figure in the modern army. I doubt my neighbors could even name a high-ranking military officer. The space program, long a source of pride, had gone the way of the dodo, and with it the celebrity astronauts. Nothing united us with the core fabric of American society. We felt trapped in two seemingly unwinnable wars, in which a disproportionate share of the fighters came from our neighborhood, and in an economy that failed to deliver the most basic promise of the American dream, a steady wage. To understand the significance of this cultural detachment, you must appreciate that much of my family's, my neighborhood's, and my community's identity derives from our love of country. I couldn't tell you a single thing about Breathitt County's mayor, its healthcare services, or its famous residents. But I do know this. Bloody Breathitt allegedly earned its name because the county filled its World War I draft quota entirely with volunteers, the only county in the entire United States to do so. Nearly a century later, and that's the factoid about Breathitt that I remember best. It's the truth that everyone around me ensured I knew. I once interviewed Mamaw for a class project about World War II. After 70 years filled with marriage, children, grandchildren, death, poverty, and triumph, the thing about which Mamaw was unquestionably the proudest and most excited was that she and her family did their part during World War II. We spoke for minutes about everything else. We spoke for hours about war rations, Rosie the Riveter, her dad's wartime love letters to her mother from the Pacific, and the day we dropped the bomb. Mamaw always had two gods, Jesus Christ and the United States of America. I was no different, and neither was anyone else I knew. I'm the kind of patriot whom people on the Acela Corridor laugh at. I choke up when I hear Lee Greenwood's cheesy anthem, "Proud to be an American." When I was 16, I vowed that every time I met a veteran, I would go out of my way to shake his or her hand, even if I had to awkwardly interject to do so. To this day, I refuse to watch Saving Private Ryan around anyone but my closest friends because I can't stop from crying during the final scene. Mamaw and Papaw taught me that we lived in the best and greatest country on earth. This fact gave meaning to my childhood. Whenever times were tough, when I felt overwhelmed by the drama and tumult of my youth, I knew the better days were ahead because I lived in a country that allowed me to make the good choices that others hadn't. When I think today about my life and how genuinely incredible it is, a gorgeous, kind, brilliant life partner, the financial security that I dreamed about as a child, great friends and exciting new experiences, I feel overwhelming appreciation for these United States. I know it's corny, but it's the way I feel. If Mamaw's second god was the United States of America, then many people in my community were losing something akin to a religion. The tie that bound them to their neighbors, that inspired them in the way my patriotism had always inspired me, had seemingly vanished. The symptoms are all around us. Significant percentages of white conservative voters, about one-third, believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim. In one poll, 32% of conservatives said that they believed Obama was foreign-born, and another 19% said they were unsure, which means that a majority of white conservatives aren't certain that Obama is even an American. I regularly hear from acquaintances or distant family members that Obama has ties to Islamic extremists, or is a traitor, or was born in some far-flung corner of the world. Many of my new friends blame racism for this perception of the president. But the president feels like an alien to many Middletonians for reasons that have nothing to do with skin color. Recall that not a single one of my high school classmates attended an Ivy League school. Barack Obama attended two of them and excelled at both. He is brilliant, wealthy, and speaks like a constitutional law professor, which of course he is. Nothing about him bears any resemblance to the people I admired growing up. His accent, clean, perfect, neutral, is foreign. His credentials are so impressive that they're frightening. He made his life in Chicago, a dense metropolis, and he conducts himself with a confidence that comes from knowing that the modern American meritocracy was built for him. Of course, Obama overcame adversity in his own right, adversity familiar to many of us, but that was long before any of us knew him. President Obama came on the scene right as so many people in my community began to believe that the modern American meritocracy was not built for them. We know we're not doing well. We see it every day in the obituaries for teenage kids that conspicuously admit the cause of death, reading between the lines, overdose, and the deadbeats we watch our daughters waste their time with. Barack Obama strikes at the heart of our deepest insecurities. He is a good father while many of us aren't. He wears suits to his job while we wear overalls if we're lucky enough to have jobs at all. His wife tells us that we shouldn't be feeding our children certain foods, and we hate her for it, not because we think she's wrong, but because we know she's right. Many try to blame the anger and cynicism of working-class whites on misinformation. Admittedly, there is an industry of conspiracy mongers and fringe lunatics writing about all manner of idiocy, from Obama's alleged religious leanings to his ancestry. But every major news organization, even the oft-maligned Fox News, has always told the truth about Obama's citizenship status and religious views. The people I know are well aware of what the major news organizations have to say about the issue. They simply don't believe them. Only 6% of American voters believe that the media is very trustworthy. To many of us, the free press, that bulwark of American democracy, is simply full of shit. With little trust in the press, there's no check on the internet conspiracy theories that rule the digital world. Barack Obama is a foreign alien actively trying to destroy our country. Everything the media tells us is a lie. Many in the white working class believe the worst about their society. Here's a small sample of emails or messages I've seen from friends or family. From right-wing radio talker Alex Jones on the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, a documentary about the so-called unanswered questions of the terrorist attacks, suggesting that the U.S. government played a role in the massacre of its own people. From an email chain, a story that the Obamacare legislation requires microchip implantation in new healthcare patients. This story carries extra bite because of the religious implications. Many believe that the end times mark of the beast, foretold in biblical prophecy, will be an electronic device. Multiple friends warned others about this threat via social media. From the popular website WorldNet Daily, an editorial suggesting that the Newtown gun massacre was engineered by the federal government to turn public opinion on gun control measures. From multiple internet sources, suggestions that Obama will soon implement martial law in order to secure power for a third presidential term. The list goes on. It's impossible to know how many people believe one or many of these stories. But if a third of our community questions the president's origin, despite all evidence to the contrary, it's a good bet that the other conspiracies have broader currency than we'd like. This isn't some libertarian mistrust of government policy which is healthy in any democracy. This is deep skepticism of the very institutions of our society, and it's becoming more and more mainstream. We can't trust the evening news. We can't trust our politicians. Our universities, the gateway to a better life, are rigged against us. We can't get jobs. You can't believe these things and participate meaningfully in society. Social psychologists have shown that group belief is a powerful motivator in performance. When groups perceive that it's in their interest to work hard and achieve things, members of that group outperform other similarly situated individuals. It's obvious why. If you believe that hard work pays off, then you work hard. If you think it's hard to get ahead even when you try, then why try at all? Similarly, when people do fail, this mindset allows them to look outward. I once ran into an old acquaintance at a Middletown bar who told me that he had recently quit his job because he was sick of waking up early. I later saw him complaining on Facebook about the Obama economy and how it had affected his life. I don't doubt that the Obama economy has affected many, but this man is assuredly not among them. His status in life is directly attributable to the choices he's made, and his life will improve only through better decisions. But for him to make better choices, he needs to live in an environment that forces him to ask tough questions about himself. There is a cultural movement in the white working class to blame problems on society or the government, and that movement gains adherence by the day. Here is where the rhetoric of modern conservatives, and I say this as one of them, fails to meet the real challenges of their biggest constituents. Instead of encouraging engagement, conservatives increasingly foment the kind of detachment that has sapped the ambition of so many of my peers. I have watched some friends blossom into successful adults and others fall victim to the worst of Middletown's temptations: premature parenthood, drugs, incarceration. What separates the successful from the unsuccessful are the expectations that they had for their own lives. Yet the message of the right is increasingly, it's not your fault that you're a loser, it's the government's fault. My dad, for example, has never disparaged hard work, but he mistrusts some of the most obvious paths to upward mobility. When he found out that I had decided to go to Yale Law, he asked whether, on my applications, I had pretended to be black or liberal. This is how low the cultural expectations of working-class white Americans have fallen. We should hardly be surprised that as attitudes like this one spread, the number of people willing to work for a better life diminishes. The Pew Economic Mobility Project studied how Americans evaluated their chances at economic betterment, and what they found was shocking. There is no group of Americans more pessimistic than working-class whites. Well over half of blacks, Latinos, and college-educated whites expect that their children will fare better economically than they have. Among working-class whites, only 44% share that expectation. Even more surprising, 42% of working-class whites, by far the highest number in the survey, report that their lives are less economically successful than those of their parents. In 2010, that just wasn't my mindset. I was happy about where I was and overwhelmingly hopeful about the future. For the first time in my life, I felt like an outsider in Middletown, and what turned me into an alien was my optimism.